Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, welcome to Horse Hour. I'm Amy Stevenson. Today we're joined by Ollie Crowe, who's a director and surgeon at B&W Equine Vets, and we're talking kissing spine. It's a subject that you've all been talking about on Horse Hour for the last few weeks, and we're especially curious about the growth of the horse's skeleton. At what age is the skeleton fully formed? Well, Ollie's going to give us the signs, the symptoms, and the treatment of kissing spine, and some extra advice too. This is Horse Hour. Welcome to the Horse Hour podcast. Now, you know these are my favourite episodes because we talk about education and we learn so much from the team at B&W Equine Vets. And today we're welcoming Ollie Crowe. He's a recognised specialist surgeon and a director of B&W. How are you, Ollie?
I'm very well, thanks. Well, welcome to everybody who's listening.
Oh, thanks so much for joining us. We've had a lot of questions on Twitter, on Horse Hour lately, particularly about kissing spine and the skeleton of the horse. So I was really hoping you could help us with some signs, some symptoms and some treatments today.
Yeah, absolutely. So kissing spine is very much, I suppose it's a diagnosis of the moment in a lot of ways, because it's something that people have become more aware of. You know, 20 years ago, people didn't really, there wasn't much talk about horses with back pain. And I think we as vets and certainly clients as well have recognised that much more these days and accept that horses are, you know, they are a lot more complex than they just get some slightly sore feet and limp a bit. There are lots of other reasons why they can't quite do the job in the way that we would like them to or they used to be able to do. Mm-hmm. And kissing spine is often a cause of that sort of thing, of just not quite performing right or ain't quite right, as we sometimes refer to them.
So is it an overall back pain? Is that what you've given? Because I'm finding from doing these episodes, I'm finding that there's names for things and they scare us. And you think, well, what is this? And actually, it's just a problem with the back.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, kissing spine is a sort of colloquial term for a very specific problem, which is where each of the vertebrae has a dorsal spinous process, which is like a shark's fin that pokes up from the top. And they should have a nice bit of space between them. There are ligaments that run between those, and that gives plenty of room for, if you think of how the horse's back moves when they're walking, trotting, and particularly cantering and jumping, the back has to bend quite a lot. And in cases of kissing spine, those bones, rather than having a nice space between them, actually sort of crush up against each other. And so they, you know, bone is not designed to crush up against bone. If it, you know, in places where it does that, you have joints and cartilage between them, and it's all nice and smooth. And that's not the case in this part of the horse's back. So that is classically what kissing spine is. Actually, you know, it's been a diagnosis we've been able to make for a long time because you could make it radiographically. But it's now started to look like actually the whole issue of horses' back pain is a little more complex than that, as you might expect. You know, if you think of all the different diagnoses that humans and to an extent dogs and cats have, they have the advantage of advanced diagnostic imaging, which we're a bit more limited with our patient size. But as I say, kissing spine is certainly a relatively common condition that we would deal with here.
Is that common? Is it? That really surprises me.
It is reasonably common. I mean, partly we see a lot of it because of where we are and what we do. You know, we filter from lots of other places, so they end up coming here. So we've got quite a large referral caseload, so, you know, we get a lot from all over the place rather than just on our doorstep. But yeah, it is relatively common. It seems to be that thoroughbreds are a bit overrepresented. Not particularly sure why that is, whether it's conformational or just some other breed relation. But we would see plenty of them in, you know, retrained racehorses, but also just, you know, thoroughbreds that are just, you know, out there doing that sport horse thing, whatever that may be, that have problems.
That's really interesting you should say that, because we had a chat on the Horse Hour podcast a few weeks ago on training horses too young. And one of the questions is, if you train a horse too young, can that contribute to them having kissing spine later on?
I guess not that we know about. And actually, the training too young is really interesting. You know, there's lots of reasons for actually training horses in their youth. So actually, if you look at, obviously completely going off subject here, but if you look at the risk of tendon injuries in National Hunt horses, those National Hunt horses that have had a flat racing career, so have been trained as babies, have a much lower risk of injuring their tendons when they're training as National Hunt horses than those that remain as stalls out in the field till they're sort of 3 or 4 or 5 and then go into National Hunt racing. So by training the skeleton, tendons are trainable up to a reasonably young age, so probably up to about 2 in thoroughbreds. And the skeleton is trainable throughout life. So as long as you get the balance right between training and overtraining, which obviously that's the $6 million question, is where that point comes. But if you get that balance right, actually training them early is a good thing. So it's not all bad. And certainly relating to kissing spines, we're not aware of overtraining in youth being a cause of that. But equally, we've not really crunched the numbers and looked at the data. So it would be an interesting thing to look into that, actually, and see, you know, the cases we see, how many of them, you know, trained as 2-year-olds or not.
Yeah.
That would be useful information to have, actually.
Yeah. It's very easy to say, well, if you're on the horse's back too young, then it's going to make a difference. But I'm fascinated at the fact that you can train earlier and you can actually train the tendons. And I'm guessing, is that to make them stronger, to help build them up?
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, a good friend of mine, Professor Roger Smith, who's he'll be delighted to be called that, but he's a professor of orthopaedics at the Royal Vet College, did some really nice, he's a sort of godfather of horse tendon research, sort of introduced stem cell therapy to the veterinary field and done some fantastic work. And absolutely, one of the things that he found in his research was that exactly that, horses' tendons can be trained to be better if you train up to the age of about 2 in thoroughbreds.
Wow.
And after that, once you've got that tendon that's as good as it's going to be, it then starts to get worse, which is a slightly depressing thing to think about. But obviously, you know, plenty of horses go until they're 30 and don't bow a tendon, but they are slowly accumulating damage,
you know,
in their tendons.
When I started doing these episodes, it was almost like skimming the surface of problems and you know, and ailments. And I'm getting more and more fascinated with how deep you guys go with your research and really how technical you can be, like the stem cell research. It's just phenomenal. He's a genius.
He is, Roger. He is. He's a very, very bright man, and also a lot of fun to be around. But he's one of those people that ought to be more recognised. You know, he doesn't blow his own trumpet, so those of us around him have to. But he's a good guy, good guy.
I'll be calling him tomorrow to see if he'll join us on the podcast.
I would.
So, just going back to the skeleton, then. What age is the skeleton fully formed in a horse?
So that's a very gradual process. So they different bits of the tendon of the skeleton, grow at different rates and mature at different rates. So the if you want an indication of how tall a horse is going to be when it's a foal, we'll look at its pastons, because the pastons reach their sort of maximum length pretty much first of all of the bits of the horse.
Can you just explain to me what a paston is?
So pastern, the bit below the fetlock, so just above the foot, the bit between the hoof and the fetlock, the first sort of obvious joint that you see, that's the pastern region. There are actually 3 bones, so very much like entirely like our finger. So the pedal bone is like the tip of our finger inside the hoof, and then there's a short pastern bone, which is like our middle digit, which comes up from the hoof, and then the longer bone, which is like the one that runs up to our knuckle, we call that the long pastern bone or proximal phalanx, if you're getting fancy. And then the fetlock is like our knuckle, basically. If you think of that rude gesture that people make with their middle finger, actually, if you turn that upside down, that's what a horse is standing on. So they're standing on their middle finger, basically, and the rest of it's all gone. So they got rid of that. But the bone just below their first knuckle is the pastern bone, and that is the first one to kind of get to its full length and stop growing, and then all the rest of them catch up from there.
Okay.
So some of the bones of the spine are still growing until horses are sort of 8 or 9, and they're some of the last ones to sort of get to their maximum size and get rid of their growth plates. And the growth plates are the system by which a bone grows. So in the foal, long before it's born, mm-hmm. their skeleton is entirely made up of cartilage. And that cartilage template that gets produced is then gradually replaced by bone, apart from these little bits at the end of the bones, which are called growth plates, which remain as little bits of cartilage and slowly thicken. Mm-hmm. And as they thicken, the bone then converts that cartilage into bone, and that's how the whole bone extends and elongates and enlarges. It's a process called endochondral ossification, and right. that's how bones get bigger, basically. And the bones of the spine are about the last ones to kind of get to that end point where they're all bone, no bits of cartilage left in there, and no more growth. And I say they can be quite late in life for that to finish.
That surprises me a little bit, because I kind of expected, I've heard different things about when the skeleton's fully formed, and it does make us wonder the ages that we get on our horse. So what age should we be getting on our horse if their skeleton isn't fully formed?
Yeah, and I think there isn't an obvious answer to that question. I mean, skeleton isn't fully formed, you know, in teenagers. You think of sort of the training that young teenagers do, our skeletons aren't fully formed often until we're at least in our late teens, and sometimes actually into our early 20s before the last of the growth plates close. And, you know, there'll be plenty of people who do pretty vigorous sports, things like rowing, boxing, you know, would have fairly, I'm not suggesting people take that up personally, but those sort of things that involve quite a bit of, and running as well, you know, quite a bit of potential trauma. But, you know, we've all evolved to kind of survive, and actually stimulating the skeleton is important, because bone is also very responsive to training. It's not just an inert substance. If you train it, it will get harder and stronger, and it will get harder and stronger in the way that it needs to become harder and stronger.
Really fascinating, because my brother was a professional rugby player at 16.
Okay.
He represented England, and he was a skinny, scrawny little thing. And I know this feels like it's off subject, but actually he did train his body. You know, he had to do certain exercises, he had to build strength in his muscle and lose fat and all that kind of thing. So I'm guessing from what you're saying, it's the way that we're riding, the styles that we're riding, we have to be aware of the skeleton and the growth plates. I'd love to be able to get a diagram from you, if possible, of where the growth plates are from the different ages, so that we know exactly what areas we've got to be protective of.
I think that whole thing of, I think it's, you're absolutely right, it's not just when we ride horses but how we ride them. And I mean, it would be fascinating to, I'd love to look at places like the Cadre Noir in Saumur, where, you know, really expert dressage riders buy horses, you know, the experts there, they get their horses when they're about 3, and they then keep them until they usually retire at 15 or 16. And I would love to look at the injury profile there, and where, you know, they're ridden by experts who, you know, I ride like a sack of potatoes. I'd be terrible at it, but it will be very interesting to look at that population and try and compare their injury profile and injury incidence horses are working very hard, but to perhaps some of the rest of us mere mortals who actually, you know, perhaps we could learn a lot from that and see whether that would reduce our injury risk in our horses. Mm. Would be, I think, a great thing to do.
Well, let us know when you do that, because I'd love to cover that too.
Absolutely. I'll have to have some trips to Saumur. That's what it is.
So then going back to the kissing spines point then. So actually, we don't know yet if there's any correlation between riding horses young and getting kissing spine.
No. And as I say, I think it could entirely be that actually, you know, riding them young and riding them properly when they're young might actually almost be slightly preventative, because they're, as with us, you know, you sort of think of lower back pain in people, that's much more common in people who sit in office chairs and spend a long time sitting down and actually not strengthening their back and not strengthening their core. Mm. Horses' backs are very similar in lots of ways. And it may well be that actually training horses reasonably young and riding them properly and getting core strength and strengthening their back muscles early might actually help to reduce the risk of kissing spines. It may not, I don't know, but it's I certainly wouldn't say that definitely riding them too early is going to be a problem.
Mm. Okay, thank you so much. So how do we then, if we're worried that our horse might have kissing spines, is it kissing spines or kissing spine?
Yeah, whichever. So there are various names for it, kissing spines or kissing spine, and impinging dorsal spinous processes or overriding dorsal spinous processes. Any of the above, it doesn't really have a proper name.
Okay, horrible back problems.
That's the one.
If we're worried that our horse might have it, what kind of signs do we need to be looking out for?
So they are hugely varied. The severity is very variable, and some of them will be just a bit off. The things they tend to struggle with first are cantering and jumping. Mm. And sometimes it will just be the horse has lost its jump a bit, or not very going flat over the jump, not basculing, tending to rush at the jumps, so that they sort of you can keep their back flat without sort of properly using it to arch or to bend and collect before the jump, through to from that sort of subtle change, bit of loss of action of the canter, maybe flagging a tail a little bit, ears back a bit when they're asked to canter, chomping on the bit a little bit, those sort of things, just signs of discomfort, sort of low-grade discomfort, through to literally you cannot get near them with a saddle because mm. they're just desperate to get anybody off their back. Mm. And proper bucking bronco type thing is the most severe way. We don't ask somebody to get on and show us what they're doing because they're sort of looking at us with broken arms and broken collarbones and that sort of thing where they've been dumped on their heads. So it can be very severe. And really almost anything in between those two extremes is what we see.
That's hard though, isn't it? Because when a horse is a little bit off, you initially go, oh, well, let's get the saddle checked. And I guess that's the first protocol.
Yeah, quite rightly. Mm. Absolutely. Yeah, exactly that. And have the physio, a lot of people will get the physio to, sort of maybe try and ease a bit of muscle spasm in their back. Again, perfectly reasonable if the horse is a bit off, particularly if it's sort of objecting a bit, getting a bit cold backed, for sure, getting the saddle checked, because, horses change shape through the year and from year to year as well. So, keeping a saddle checked regularly with a good saddler is absolutely, is a vital part of keeping them healthy. Mm. But it can be very, we struggle sometimes with the diagnosis. Another thing that's quite common actually is people, they come in and they say, my horse is lame, and you look at it and you think, well, it's not. And sometimes we'll put the lameness locator on, which is a device for measuring symmetry of movement, and that tells you the horse isn't lame, and you're sort of scratching your head because somebody very sensibly is standing in front of you saying, well, listen, when I ride my horse, it's lame. Mm. And you get them on board and suddenly it's a very different clinical picture of a very obviously uncomfortable horse that just ain't quite right. And it's sometimes quite difficult to put your finger on what it is about it that isn't quite right. And the signs can be very vague.
Doesn't help us though.
Keeps our lives interesting.
Yeah, your job's hard enough as it is. We need a paint by numbers, really.
Yeah, exactly.
Is there with some injuries or with some issues, there's heat? Would there be any heat on the horse's back? Is there anything that we could feel for?
No, and interestingly, I mean, on point, there's been a lot of interest recently in thermography, and we're struggling at the moment to find, which, it's a nice idea that obviously it's inflamed and painful. At the moment, we're struggling a little bit to tie up thermographic signs with clinical signs. In fact, we no longer have a thermography camera in us. We did have a little while ago now, mm. and we didn't find that useful actually. Which obviously will companies like Sync Thermography, I know, are trying to do it perhaps a little more rigorously than maybe we did. But we're struggling to. So even with that very sensitive detector of changes of temperature, I think we struggle to detect heat. What you can sometimes detect, and as a nice sign to look for, is the muscle spasm that is often associated with back pain.
Oh, okay.
And that's where essentially, if you run your fingers down their back, either side of the midline where the bony lumps of the spine are, those big chunky muscles, if you give those a good squeeze, just like if you've been to the gym and overdone it and somebody comes and pokes you in the arm where it's sore, that, you know, it's a very similar response. What you tend to do is to tense against them and then quietly ask them to stop doing that. And, you know, horses don't always quietly ask you to stop doing that, but they do tense against you. It's a very subjective thing. So, you know, I have to be aware when I walk up and poke a horse in the back that if a stranger walked up and poked me in the back, I might be a bit tense. and it's very much the same with horses, that, you know, it's a very subjective sign, that. But certainly having a good feel down your horse's back, especially if you, you know, obviously they know you, so they're more relaxed about you being around there, the main muscles of their back. If they're used to being handled there, and when you start squeezing, they get very, you know, they're sort of tensing their muscles against you and it feels very hard, then that may be a sign that they've, you know, that they have some muscle spasm in there. And one of the things that can cause that is kissing spine. They obviously they can get bruised muscles, they can also overwork like we do. So it doesn't necessarily mean your horse has kissing spine, but that's one sort of sign that you can look for that there may be a problem.
I guess it's putting all the signs together, isn't it? Because individually we get those things all the time. I mean, Blackjack, when I first got him, he tensed loads when I put the saddle on him, but that was because he'd had saddles thrown on his back. So it's a collective view, isn't it? If they're riding differently, if they've got their ears back, if they're not, like you said, not jumping.
The other thing, actually, interestingly, is that these problems will often start when they've had time off for something else. Which again is a very common part of the history, actually, that, you know, had a lameness, did a tendon, something like that, had some time off, and when it came back, all of a sudden it's just not happy being ridden, got a bit cold backed. And again, probably, you know, relating to our discussion earlier on about the importance of building muscle, that may be that they're actually, whilst they've been, when they're fit and strong, they're able to support their back in a way that is comfortable for them. When they lose that, they're not able to, and their back sags a bit. And that means that those processes kind of impact more against each other, or they're not so able to hold their back in a way that's comfortable for them. So again, that's something else just to watch out for. If you start to experience these problems after your horse has had some time off, that would be a relatively common history for a horse with kissing spine.
I really wish you could come out with your magic machine and just do a full MOT of our horses. Like, you know, almost like a car wash, where we just walk them through them and say, right, every year you go to different yards and do an MOT, and we can tell, because it would be so great. A problem with kissing spine is so severe. The thought of having a horse with its, you know, its bones rubbing together, it would be great if we could catch all that much earlier. But like you said, it's so difficult to be able to see really what's going on inside.
It is. I mean, I think from an owner's point of view, the thing is to know your horse and to know when things change. And so it's often a lot more clear cut, and people, you know, we've had this horse for 5 years. It's never, you know, coughed once out of place. It's always been a very relaxed horse, and now it's getting grumpy when we get on board. That's the time to call your vet and get them to come and have a look at that. It is more difficult when, you know, we've just bought this horse and it seemed all right when we tried it, but now it's getting grumpier and grumpier. Nobody's quite sure whether actually it just doesn't enjoy its current environment as much as the previous, or, and, you know, with all due respect as well, different riding styles, different environments that they're in. It's not uncommon actually to see these problems start when they change hands, which obviously, you know, causes some upset on both sides, because somebody sold a horse that has never put a foot wrong, somebody's bought a horse that's never put a foot right, and somewhere in the middle is the how's this happened? And actually, that's not an uncommon history either. That just change of owner, change of rider, and think, you know, the wheels start to come off.
Oh, God. Makes us not want to buy a horse, doesn't it, really?
I never buy a horse. It's a crazy thing to do.
And really interesting that you said that thoroughbreds tend to suffer with kissing spine more than the more chunkier breeds.
Yes. Yeah, and as I say, we don't really know why, but it's just something that we have noticed, over the years. And certainly when we followed up the surgical technique that we use for treating this condition a little while back, and when we looked at the breeds that were involved, it was thoroughbreds were heavily overrepresented. So we have a real sort of mix of horses that come through our clinic, but those that came through with kissing spine, there were far more of them were thoroughbreds than the general population. So it does seem to be a breed predisposition.
Well, we'll work on that because that could be, you know, that in my really silly, you know, amateur brain, I'm thinking, well, maybe it's because their skeletons aren't strong enough to be able to have people on their back so much, or maybe we're putting a little bit too much pressure on their bones.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, it's possible. It may just be a conformational thing that the shape of them, it just means that they are more likely to get kissing spines. That's and as I say, actually, theories are great, but what we need is evidence, because it may be that actually we need to work them harder. And I know that sounds like a daft thing to say, but it is possible that actually we need to spend more time working them and perhaps working them more correctly to build their strength so that their backs are stronger. In the same way that, you know, if you've got a bad back these days, you often won't get told to go and lie quietly. You let it settle down a bit and then get sent for a Pilates class. Because actually what you need to do is to get stronger, not weaker.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it may well be that actually we need to be doing more of that sort of thing and more physio and that kind of thing than actually doing less work with them. Mm. That's certainly possible.
So we've got lots of research ahead of us, Ollie. We've got to get on it, really, haven't we?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
you touched on the surgery, on how do you deal with kissing spine if a horse is, you know, you've diagnosed it. Is it diagnosing through MRI scans? Is that how you diagnose it?
No, sadly not. But much as we would love to, we're really very heavily reliant on X-ray. So plain old radiography. You know, we're very lucky here. We've got a very powerful X-ray machine, and almost more importantly, we have a very experienced radiographer. She literally wrote the book. So,
oh, wow.
Radiography the Horse by Jan Butler. If any vets out there want to go and buy that book, it's well worth it. It's the standard text for the veterinary industry, or the equine veterinary industry, and she gets amazing radiographs for us. And they, you know, unfortunately, we scintigraphy, so bone scan, can be a useful diagnostic technique as well. We would love to have CT and MRI for horses' backs, and whilst we have CT and MRI, they aren't made big enough for us to get a horse's back into. We got some amazing images of horses' necks and heads with our CT scanner, fantastic lower limb MRI views, but unfortunately the bit in the middle, which it would be fantastic to have MRI and CT images for, unfortunately, but they just aren't made big enough, unfortunately, at the moment.
But, oh, that's a shame.
We'll keep asking. Mm-hmm. Somebody might. Somebody for a small price, I'm sure we'll build one eventually.
So what do? We take the horse to you, you put it through the X-ray machine, and that's how you can tell and officially say, yes, he's got it, or no, he hasn't.
Yeah, so that's how you tell that they have what we would call radiographic signs, or that they technically have kissing spines, because you can see the bony reaction, you can see the bone butting up against bone. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that that is the cause of the horse's problem, because some horses will have X-ray changes that show you that their, you know, bone has butted against bone, but actually that isn't necessarily the cause of their pain. Some of these don't seem to cause discomfort.
Hmm.
It's probably true that there was a study quite a long time ago, I mean, back before even I was a vet, that looked at essentially somebody at the Animal Health Trust asked everybody arriving with their horse if their horse had back pain, and then x-rayed all of their backs. And some of the people who said, a reasonable number of the people who said their horse didn't have back pain, their horses did have kissing spines.
Now,
it's slightly different era, and it may well be that I think we are better at detecting back pain in horses now, so maybe some of those were missed, but undoubtedly we've certainly seen horses competing at, you know, four-star eventing that have outrageous x-rays on their back, and they certainly appear to be working perfectly effectively, and so, you know, with those ones, it then makes you question some of the ones that have milder signs that, you know, have some, you know, some pretty ferocious clinical signs.
But that's not surprising, Ollie, is it? I mean, let's be honest. If I hurt my arm, you know, I can deal with it. My other half, if he hurts his arm, he's got to be in bed for a week. It's just
at least a week, I'd imagine. Yeah, exactly.
It's personalities, isn't it? Some horses can deal
exactly.
with pain.
Yeah, exactly. Solidarity with your other half. Yeah. I'm on his side, definitely. absolutely that is, first of all, some horses can deal with it, and undoubtedly some of those, you know, might actually benefit from a bit of treatment, but I'm sure there are some horses that are genuinely perfectly comfortable with it, and their bones have changed enough that they're sort of slightly wrapping around each other, but now that, you know, the pain side of it is done and they're not painful. So that's the what we have to decide then is whether the horse is responding in the way that it's responding when it's ridden, or that's why it's not quite right because of that, or whether actually that's a very interesting thing, but that's not cause of the horse's problem. Mm. And that can be a really difficult thing to decide. So one thing we can do is to inject local anaesthetic around those sites, make the whole area go numb, and then see them ridden again. So see them ridden first, make that area of their back go numb so they can't feel it, and then see them ridden again. And sometimes, again, you'll see a dramatic change from a horse that you're really worrying somebody's about to get launched into orbit to a horse that just lunges, trots around, you know, canters nicely, very relaxed, and, you know, then everybody's happy.
But you can't put anaesthetic in their back every time you want to ride them. So how would you
better? So there are various things. Some horses can respond to just physiotherapy, strengthening up, you know, spending some time working long and low, building the muscles of their back up, having some physiotherapy to relieve some of the muscle spasm that they get related to that, which is part of the painful bit. Mm. And also to specifically strengthen some of the small postural muscles that are important in keeping their spine in alignment, just like yours or mine. If we go and sit in an office chair and do that for 8 hours a day, some of our small postural muscles that kind of keep us, you don't really notice that you're using, but little muscles that everybody.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
He sits up straight when I say that.
Yeah, I did.
some of the small postural muscles will get weak if you get back pain. And actually, to rebuild those muscles, you have to do specific exercises. And that's why, you know, that's where physios really come into their own, is rebuilding some of those postural muscles. So mild cases can be treated conservatively. Sometimes we'll inject their back with a bit of steroid, corticosteroid, which is a very potent anti-inflammatory. Mm. And again, sometimes all that does is buys you a bit of time, so gets you to the end of the season. Or obviously, in some, you know, this is something that tends to get worse as horses get older. And you know, if you've only got a one or two seasons left in the horse anyway, and you don't want to put them through anything too severe, then some steroid injections can just kind of help them along a little bit, just to kind of get to the end of their career anyway. And there are the various options for surgery as well.
Oh, that's good.
To relieve the impingement there.
And how do you do that? You can't take the bone out, can you?
There are multiple slightly different ways of doing it. The most basic but can be effective is to cut the ligament that runs between those bones. And the idea of that is that you, by releasing that tension between the bones, you can allow the muscles of the back to spread those bones further apart. And then you do some fairly intensive physiotherapy to move those bones further apart. Now, it may well be that by cutting that actually the ligament itself is a bit painful. Mm. And so by cutting that, you just make it more comfortable. So that can work with some. In our caseload, and caseloads vary, you know, different types of horses, different uses of horses from clinic to clinic. We've not found that all that useful, because with our caseload, there's an awful lot of horses where there's an enormous amount of bony reaction around those sort of points of contact, which means that the ligament isn't really there anymore. You just got sort of bone sort of locked together with bone. And so we do tend to remove bits of bone. What we used to do is to cut the top off every other, every second vertebra. So you create an enormous amount of space between them, or every second process, sorry. So you essentially end up with something that looks a bit like the top of a castle turret, sort of one tall one, one short one, one tall one, one short one, which worked very nicely. But it's a pretty invasive technique. There's a lot of tissue is damaged, potentially unnecessarily. Sort of healthy tissue is damaged, and when you do surgery, you always want to you need to achieve the goals that need to be achieved, but hopefully do as little damage as possible. And any time you wield a scalpel or a surgical instrument, we are doing damage. Obviously, tissues didn't evolve to be cut through. They have amazing healing abilities, but the less damage we can do, the better. So what we tend to do now is to, rather than taking the whole of the top of the process off, is to simply take off the front of the process. So if you think of it as a fairly sort of square shark's fin, we just take a little piece of a little sliver of bone off the front of that. So rather than that bit of bone bashing up against the one in front, there's a space between it and the one in front. And possibly the easiest way to sort of show you that is to get you some x-rays of before and after, so you can kind of see this is an impacting bone and this is space between bone.
That'd be amazing.
It's slightly easier to sort of see it than to try and explain it if you haven't got a bit of back in front of you where you can point it out.
You're just so clever, Ollie. I never even...
No, it's very simple stuff.
I said jokingly, like, you can't cut a bit of bone off, but you can, and the horse is okay
absolutely. Yeah, and actually it's something, I mean, one of the other advantages of that, we end up making very small incisions, so it's sort of, the incisions are about a centimetre or so long. We do it blind, but under radiographic guidance, so we're creating much less trauma. But the, almost the best thing about it is the horse is conscious, standing,
they
just have a bit of sedation, local anaesthetic. And then, so they're not anaesthetised, they don't have that risk. And also, anaesthesia is compromised for horses as well. There are many times when we have to do it to get the job done. But for jobs like this and some of the, head surgeries and fracture repair that we do, actually keeping them conscious and standing is quite the best way to do it.
And so I guess it's like keyhole surgery.
Yes, it is. I mean, it's the incision size is about the same as, it's probably slightly longer than we would make for an arthroscopy. Which would be as keyhole surgery on joints. But yeah, absolutely. The aim is to do as little damage as possible. And they do seem to be a lot more comfortable post-operatively, which would make sense because we've done a lot less damage to them. So yeah, hopefully they do seem to be pretty perky, the day after surgery once the local anaesthetic's worn off than they used to be when we did it the other way.
And how long is normally the recovery process? I guess it's different. I know it's different from if you've got physio, that'll take a long time before you get to the surgery point. But let's say you have a horse that you do this surgery with. What kind of time scale are you looking at?
So they have 4 weeks of box rest and walking exercise. They have their skin, sutures and staples taken out a couple of weeks after surgery. So four weeks in the box, but they're walking straight away. We get them fed from the floor. So they're getting their head down and stretching their backs. And they can get out and graze in hand just to give those wounds time to heal up and get nice and strong. And then they can be turned out, and they have 6 weeks turned out in the paddock, not being ridden, but started to lunge either in a Pessoa or an Equiband or Equiami to get them trying to work a little bit long and low and stretch their backs. And we very much encourage people to get physios to help them as well with stretches and to start rebuilding those muscles and giving them exercises. And they're much more able than we are to work with them on a very much a one-to-one basis, because the physio can show the client, the owner, what exercises to do, and then come back and make sure they're doing them properly and keep going back and visiting essentially helping to walk them through the process of rehabilitation. It's essentially a 10-week program before you get back on their, in most cases, before you get back on their back and start riding again.
Ollie, I'm mesmerised. I'm so, I can't explain to you. you've taken us on this huge journey of, you know, we can't really tell what the kissing spine is to, okay, we've worked it out, the horse is in horrific pain, is bucking people off and people are almost dying, getting severe injuries to being thrown off.
To a
horse where it can have a little bit of physiotherapy and we can work through it and try and take it better, to the surgery, which sounded so horrific to start with and like it was a huge trauma, but it's not a trauma. You've brought us back to this really lovely, positive, you know, it's a small surgical, it's a big surgical procedure, but you do it in a small way,
yeah,
to only three weeks, 3 months off. That's incredible.
Yes. Yeah. And that's what we aim for. You know, unfortunately, what we have to accept as surgeons is that we're never going to have 100% success rate. And so there are some horses that don't respond to surgery. And, we work very hard with each and every one of them to try and make sure that it's successful. We have a very experienced team here. But people obviously need to understand as well that there's no such thing as 100% success. Mm. Actually, you know, across the board, including yours and my surgery as well, there are risks involved. We try and minimise those risks by doing things like not anaesthetising them, keeping incisions small and that sort of thing. But the majority do well and respond nicely to surgery. When we followed up our cases, it's a little while ago now, we sort of followed up the first 120 or so that we did, which we presented at a meeting a little while back. I think it was about 77% of horses that just had kissing spine, that was their only problem. Mm. Went back to full work and everybody was happy. If they had other issues, and that's always a problem, is it lame as well? Then obviously the stats start to work a little bit more against you. So about 55% of those that were lame at the same time went back to full work because undoubtedly some of those, the more issues you've got, the harder it is to get past all of them.
Absolutely. So and sometimes
numbers down.
It's just amazing. But the kissing spine, can that lead? Often I hear explanations, if there's a problem with a horse in one area, they overcompensate in another area. So do you find other issues because of the kissing spine?
Yeah, it's a very good question. A little bit chicken and egg as to, so yes, we often do. Horses often have multiple issues, and absolutely, was it the kissing spine that caused them to overwork their suspensories? Or traditionally we've tended to think more along the lines of sort of lameness causing back pain, in the same way that if you or I walk around with one shoe on and one shoe off for a while, we'll get lower back pain. Mm. If a horse is asymmetric because it's lame, then they will develop a weaker and uncomfortable back. But I think we're probably a little more questioning now as to whether which is the primary thing. And you talk to physios who do a lot of human work, then they're used to dealing with multiple problems, and this slight gait abnormality leads to that sore knee, which leads to that sore hip, which leads to that lower back pain, and actually you have to try and deal with all of those. And by the time you get to that point, it almost doesn't matter which one came first and which started it, because those are the issues that you've got, and sometimes they are multiple. And it's been a really interesting thing. I think we have computers that help us with lameness diagnosis and makes us better at that. Again, we're getting more and more of a clearer picture of just how complex some of these cases are, in terms of their entire overall problem. And sometimes if you treat sort of part of it, that gets everything else better enough that they can carry on and are perfectly comfortable. But obviously, sometimes if you only treat part of the problem, you only get part of a response.
And I'll be honest, if I'm going to come to you, I want you to fix him completely. I don't want you to say, absolutely, well, we're going to leave the leg hanging off there.
Yeah.
There's no point, is there?
No, exactly. Three-legged horses, yeah. That's overrated.
It really is amazing. What's lovely is that kissing spine can be fixed. Not the end of the horse, which is really lovely. Do you know, I know I've thrown you on the spot here, I don't need exact figures, but just kind of percentage-wise, how many people that you've diagnosed with kissing spine that you just sent a physio, that you try and work before you get, like at what point do they then go to the surgeon? Do you perform surgery on them?
Yeah. Yes, yeah. To be honest, it's one of the things, it does vary. Clearly, it varies a lot between horses, and it varies a lot between clients. So some people, I guess the two extremes are perfectly sensibly, for some people, the idea of having surgery on their horse is an absolute anathema, and they don't want that done. Mm. They don't want to put the horse through that. However minimally invasive we tend to think of it, it's still a thing for a horse to go through. And so they don't want that, which is absolutely fine. The other end of the spectrum is, listen, we're not sure how much this is actually affecting the horse, but they want the problem got rid of because it's a young horse and they don't like the idea of managing a problem. They want it fixed, which again is perfectly understandable and perfectly reasonable. As to what percentage of people, want to go one way or the other, yeah, that'd be a difficult one to answer. I think
I meant more like in terms of, okay, you've got 10 horses. Do you find more are needing this is a better way of asking it. Okay, so let's say you've got a group of horses. Are you finding that more need surgery for the kissing spine than the guys that can have physiotherapy, or is it more the other way around? Because what I don't want is for everybody to be panicking that their horse might have kissing spine and that they're going to have to go through this trauma of surgery.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you're looking for a long-term solution to the problem, then the majority of horses probably would end up having surgery, which is no way to mean that plenty of horses don't do absolutely fine and are pain-free and work well without having surgery for this condition. The other thing that owners often find is actually when you tell them their horse has kissing spine, obviously there's the, oh my God, my horse has got kissing spine, followed by the relief of, you know, they've often spent months, if not years, being told that they're not riding their horse properly, they're not getting into contact, all those sorts of things, and they just can't, you know, the horse cannot or will not do what it needs to do. And actually the relief sometimes when you tell them that not only is that your horse actually has a problem, it's a problem that's potentially fixable, that can be a huge relief. And it's one of the, you know, inevitably doing our job, we have clients, you know, in tears now and again. And actually, one of the most routine times for that is when we block a horse's back and they ride them, and suddenly they've got the horse back they thought they had however many years ago, and it's not trying to kill them, and it's not their fault. It's, you know, it's a physical thing that's stopping it from doing that. It's not your bad riding. And genuinely, that's a, you know, it's a very regular time for tears to well up and sort of you kind of get all that emotional feedback from all those years of abuse they've had from their friends and their horse, and
all of a sudden it
makes sense as to why it is.
And we put a lot of pressure on ourselves as horse owners to do the best for them, and I think we doubt ourselves, we question our own abilities a lot, and the last thing we want is to be the reason that our horse is unwell.
100%. I mean, I never have a problem doubting my abilities as a rider because I know they're awful, but it's a very complex area, and unfortunately that means that the decision making is difficult. We'd love to have a fully functional crystal ball to be able to truly tell people what the outcome was, and it may well be in future, as I say, when we do get better imaging of horses' backs, we may well find out that all those other reasons that mean that sometimes this doesn't work, and we'll be able to choose our cases better. And so hopefully we'll be able to say, you know, with some degree of certainty that, you know, in your horse, if we do this surgery, it will work. And in your horse, if we just medicate here, it will work. Unfortunately, as with so many other things, that's a little way off at the moment.
We will get there, though. The Animal Health Trust are doing amazing work on saddles at the moment, saddle fitting and the impact on the horse's back. So it won't be long before we work on that. So going just backwards a little bit to what can we do as owners or as riders to prevent our horses getting kissing spine, or at least help stop that problem from happening?
I think keeping them fit. I think we mentioned before that one of the risk factors for these things becoming clinically evident is having time off for some other reason. Now, obviously, you can't avoid having time off, and it doesn't mean that if your vet says your horse has got a tendon injury, it's got to be in the box for, you know, a prolonged period of time. Don't ignore that just in case your horse might get kissing spine, because that's not the right thing to do. But as in general management, if we can keep them fit and strong, keep them riding so that, you know, you're working on their, the strength of their back. You're keeping a nice strong top line on them, which actually, just reminded me that that's one of the things to, if your horse has a very sort of poor top line, so they, rather than a nice rounded appearance to its back, it's sort of quite spiky with the in the middle, the bones in the middle are quite obvious, and not much muscle either side of them. That can be a sign of back pain. But yeah, keeping them nice and strong, nice and fit, regular exercise, regular physiotherapy is probably useful as well. And good saddle fit.
Good saddle fit. The bone that you said that was sticking out, I would have presumed that that was just down to the horse needing to put on a little bit more weight rather than, it's interesting. How is it a sign?
Yeah,
of...
probably not, doesn't, don't, they don't want to put on weight. I mean, it's actually, I think relatively, well, very rare actually for a horse to be truly underweight. I mean, obviously there are conditions where horses, you know, get underweight, and for some disciplines like showing, obviously they tend to need a slightly more rounded outline. Mm-hmm. But actually what you really want to put on is muscle. And when the bones of the back are looking more prominent, it's usually because they are not particularly well muscled. You know, if you think of a bony long distance runner, they're pretty wiry, but they don't have big muscles on them. What most of our animals want is to have a really strong back, so plenty of muscle, and that should hide the bones of the back quite well. So yeah, keeping them strong, doing plenty of fitness training with them, hopefully will help that. And actually, as I say, taking advice from a physio, maybe spending some time lunging in a psoa or an equiamy or an equiband. Equibands might be slightly kinder to them, so it's not forcing their necks down quite so much, but still getting them to engage their core and strengthen up their core muscles, all those sorts of things. And probably, and this is, as I say, spoken as somebody who is quite the worst rider in Gloucestershire, actually probably getting, you know, continuing to get good instruction from good instructors for our riding as well, to, you know, make sure we're riding them properly. And as I say, if anybody wants, I probably ought to put a YouTube video of me trying to ride a horse up, just so nobody feels I'm being rude or condescending, because I really am a terrible rider. I just feel bad for the horse if I was doing that. But as I say, I think probably, you know, keeping well instructed, I know some very, very good event riders who still go for dressage lessons. And maybe that's another thing, actually. Dressage lessons probably for horse and rider are very useful. It's a very important discipline. And it's, you know, if you think of the strength of ballerinas, Pilates was developed to train ballerinas. And essentially, you know, in its simplest sense, dressage is ballet for horses, and it works on their core strength and helps them to build strength in their back. So maybe going and for those people who much rather be, you know, ragging it around a cross country course, actually going and having some dressage lessons is a, you know, useful thing to do.
Do it. I love it. I'm such a dressage fan. 4 feet on the ground, dancing with the horses, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. None of this high speed taking off nonsense.
Definitely not. I do love the athletic side of dressage, and I it's like gymnastics. I find it really fascinating. And you touched on the point of, you know, having a horse's head low and low and long. And I'm a massive believer in that, Ollie. It frustrates me when I see people that are pulling their horse's head in all the time to get them in contact or on the bit, or, you know, it's... that surely can't build up the top line if you're constantly putting your horse's head and up and in all the time.
Yeah, it's very interesting, actually. What's a lovely thing to see, and I've seen demonstrated a few times, in thin-skinned thoroughbreds are great because they are an anatomy lesson in themselves, because they, very fit young thoroughbreds, have very little fat under their skin and very thin skin, so you can really see what their muscles are doing. And if you watch one of those horses literally just put its head down to graze in a normal way, you'll see the muscles of its belly contract and lift. And that's essentially what we want horses to do, because that is then strengthening their core. You know, that's essentially like a Pilates sit-up. And so absolutely, getting the head position right and engaging their back end is helping to strengthen their backs. And it's a very nice thing for me to say, you know, go and do that. I genuinely could not achieve that while I was riding a horse. I'm really not being modest. I'm a terrible rider. I couldn't do that. But there are lots of people out there that can help riders ride better.
Yeah.
And in doing that, prevention is always better than cure. And so it's, if we can at least you know, we could probably, those of us that do ride, probably ought to just maybe spend a little bit more time. I certainly should, you know, actually going to see good trainers and just kind of getting a bit of help with our, you know, our riding in general.
Mm-hmm. We all need help.
And yeah, we do. And say, please don't get me wrong. That's not to suggest that horses are getting kissing spine because they're being ridden badly. I'm not suggesting that at all. But I think in general, horses' back health is probably best looked after by being ridden well. That, you know, that may reduce some of the risks. Nobody should feel if they have a diagnosis of kissing spines that they could necessarily prevented it by treating their horse differently. It's not bad at all. But yeah, as I say, I think riding lessons are underrated, mm-hmm. and they are very important.
And building up the strength can just help. Yep. It could possibly help a little bit into the horse not having kissing spine. But ultimately, you know, we are all learning all the time how to improve our riding. Oh, yeah. And you could be the best rider in the country, but you still have lessons. Michael Young still has lessons.
Yeah.
You know, Gemma Tattersall has lessons. But what I don't want to do for my horse is for my riding to affect him. So if I'm riding wrong, then that's only going to affect him in a negative way. And things like you said, you know, you can't ride, so you wouldn't be able to build the top line of your horse. Well, I pay another girl to ride my horse 3 times a week to create that lift and to build his muscle, because I know I'm not good enough. And I know we can't all, you know, afford someone else to ride their horse, and sometimes I eat beans on toast for 3 nights a week to pay for it. But, you know, it's what you could have a friend that's a really good rider. She can get the horse's head down. Maybe she could help a couple of times a week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. All the things. And also sometimes actually just having somebody else ride the horse, because they will be different from you. You know, when you're sort of worrying, is it right, is it not? Just getting somebody else to have a ride and see whether they have the same problems or whether they finding the same things getting them going. And again, to not be proud about that. You know, we are all learning all the time. Mm. And, you know, that can be a useful thing to do as well. Can certainly be helpful, and as I say, accepting that none of us are perfect is the first step to kind of getting a little bit nearer to perfection.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Oh well, Ollie Crowe, thank you so much for joining us today. Were you at badminton this year?
Yes, yeah. So we do we're the treating vets for badminton and various others. But yeah, I in fact that's the only one of the events that I do. So I'm there for the whole time.
Yeah, I vaguely remember feeling like a paparazzi, because I think I took a photo of you while you were backstage laughing as Jonty Evans came out, and you and a treating vet. And
I'm sure I was concentrating very hard.
You look like you were having the best time. I thought, oh my goodness, if I could be a vet just to enjoy that day. Did you have fun?
it was tremendously hard work the whole time, and if any of my co-workers are listening to this, then it was murder. That's why I looked tired by the time I finished. No, it was great fun. It's a lovely place to be, and you know, it's great crowds of people, both, you know, within the competition and outside. It's an amazing team of people running that competition, and you know, it's actually a great catch-up time as well. You know, particularly cross country day. You know, there's a vet on every jump. There's three surgical specialists on the course. There's, you know, I'm a surgical specialist. I'm in the stables. Richard Hepburn, who's an internal medicine specialist, one of my colleagues here, is in the stables. John Killingbeck, you know, very well known ex-Olympic team vet, he's in the stables with us. You know, it's a massive social as well. Yeah, and it's always a good time to get together, and we have a meeting in advance of badminton, sort of February, March time, to kind of exchange ideas and see what we can do better, all those sorts of things. So it's actually a really positive veterinary experience, as well as a lot of fun and with a bit of shopping locked in from the side as well.
Well, you're welcome to that photo. You both look very happy. Well, there were a couple of accidents, though, weren't there? There were a couple of horses that fell. Did you have to treat any of those?
Yeah, no, there were a few tumbles, but actually, just trying to remember now. I don't think there was anything that was. I think one of the riders obviously was a bit injured, but actually, horse wise, I think we had a very little more than little lumps and bumps. Very, you know, one of the sort of definitely a good year in that respect. Mm. You know, obviously there are always risks involved, and you know, people shouldn't forget the risks involved in not training your horses and, you know, having unfit horses pottering around in the field. We see far more injuries from those sort of horses than from, you know, well-trained eventers. But there are some risks involved, but it was a nice, safe year. Beautiful course. Eric doesn't need any more big me up than from me, but he can do that for himself. Mm. But great course. And I think it was a very successful badminton this time round.
It was lovely to see. I've seen a bit of a shift over the last few years into more awareness about the horse welfare. And we live streamed the veterinary inspections, which I thought was great. You know, there's crowds of people that go down to watch the trot up. It's become a bit of a fashion show now before the next event. And I think it's great. You know, you really are seeing the fact that the horse's welfare comes first. And I think it's amazing.
Yeah, I know it is. It's a vital part that people understand how seriously that's taken, because obviously, you know, they are what it's all about. Mm. So yeah, it is what people see that side of it.
Well, Ollie, thank you so much. I've taken up more than enough of your time. I know that you're really busy and you've probably got to go back into surgery.
Go and see what's going on out there.
Yeah, but we can follow you on Twitter. You are at BW Equine Vets, and you're on Facebook as well. And we'll see you badminton next year.
Absolutely. We'll all be there. Thanks very much.
See you, Ollie. Cheers. Okay. Bye.
Cheers then. Bye now.
Thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode on Kissing Spine. If there's anything you'd really like to know about, or a guest that you'd really like to hear on the podcast, then drop me a message. You can send a DM on Twitter, you can send a message on Facebook or Instagram, or you can email team@horsehour.co.uk. After all, I make these podcasts for you, so if there's a particular subject, or maybe there's a veterinary problem you're worried about, then send me a message and I'll find a suitable guest for you. You can listen to previous episodes of the Horse Hour podcast on our website. Just head to horsehour.co.uk, also on iTunes and Acast too. And while you're on our website, you can see all the pictures from Gatcombe Horse Trials this weekend. It was a very wet and windy and muddy day, and the horses were phenomenal, because if you're like me, afraid of going out in wind and rain, definitely wouldn't go out in storms, then these riders are just insane. The mud was horrific and they were still going down the cross-country courses. The pictures are awesome, so I hope you enjoy looking at those. You can also see some videos of like the warm-up arena. William Fox Pitt was there, Gemma Tattersall was there, Izzy Taylor, some brilliant riders. And it was lovely to meet one of Izzy's protégés. Her name's Ivy. She's 19 and she was riding her young horse. So hopefully next week at Blenheim, we'll be catching up with some of these riders again, and you'll be able to hear them on the Horse Hour podcast, as well as Christina Henriksen. We can have a catch up and see how her last few events have been. And also Aaron Miller. I went to his yard. He's a 4-star rider. I went there a few weeks ago, and he'll be running his ponies too. I say ponies. These are like amazingly beautiful horses. Hope you've had a really good week with your horse. Keep sharing your photos and your videos on Twitter and Instagram, and hope you have a great week with your horse, and I'll speak to you soon.
You've been listening to Horse Hour. Join the community on Twitter, Mondays, 8 p.m. UK time, 3 p.m. Eastern, by using the hashtag HorseHour. Follow Amy at AmyStevenson1 and subscribe to us on Acast, iTunes, Stitcher and Player FM.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.